This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Ah, yes. That sound means the Science Friday Science Club is now in session, our exercise in citizen science. And last month, we challenged you to go out and observe everything. Everything, anything that caught your fancy. We wanted you to observe something in the world around you that interested you, figure out a way of keeping track of it, document what you saw, and report back, share it with us. And boy, you really came through. We received about 100 of observations. Did you observe something? Give us a call. Our number, 844-724-8255. We'll talk about it. We want to know what you were studying and why. And two of our charter members of the Science Club are with us, Science Friday's education manager, Ariel Zitch, and director, Charles Berquist. Welcome back to the club.
Thanks, Ariel.
Ariel, refresh our memory. How well did we do? What kind of feedback did we get?
Well, people were really enthusiastic about this project. We knew that most scientific discoveries have started with observation. We know that observation is this gateway into curiosity and discovery. And so it's not too surprising. And yet the questions, the creativity, the things that people wouldn't have noticed otherwise, it just burst forth.
Mm-hmm. And we asked people to go out and see anything that they were looking for, anything that interested them.
Literally anything. And some people had been observing for a while, but some people, you know, they just happened to be on a hike. Maybe they noticed an ant crawling across the ground. Some people, you know, maybe wanted to explore something deeper anyway and so decided to conduct their own observational experiment. But we weren't really very picky about it at all.
So you had all kinds of responses, Charles.
Sure. We had things completely over the map. I mean, at the most basic level, there were people who were just saying, wow, it's fall. The leaves are turning colors. Look at that. And, you know, that was the sort of simplest type of observation. Mm-hmm. But we had people who, there was one woman who had sent us her birding life lists. She has been an avid birder for years, and she sent us her complete compilation of everything that she's ever seen with specifics about the dates that she saw certain species return to her neighborhood, and has this correlation of, well, if it's the 18th of March, it must be time to see whatever. So there were some people that this is what they do, and they did a really good job at it.
And we posted everything up online.
Yes, everything's online at sciencefriday.com/observeeverything. You can actually look through some of the highlights that we're going to discuss today. It was a hard choice, and we never really chose. I mean, we tried to feature everything, but there were so many that it was actually difficult to do. I mean, just for some of the events that we had this month, we had, you know, a couple of lunar eclipses, a solar eclipse, but we had tons of observations just from those events. Mm. On top of all of the things that people have been noticing in their everyday life and maybe never even thought about taking a gander at.
Give us one that stands out that was submitted.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
there was one about spiders on there that was really cool.
There was actually many about spiders. So May had made pretty regular observations of spiders. She actually tweeted them to us just about every day. She had some Argiope spiders outside of her home. And it wasn't just one. It wasn't just two. It was many spiders all aggregating around in this kind of shared space. And she observed how they ate prey. She observed whether they moved. She observed what happened to them before and after the rain. She observed if there were other species of spiders around them. It was pretty dedicated. We thought it was kind of interesting, so we looked into it.
Yeah, so we commend her dedication in documenting the spiders around her house. So we reached out to a couple of spider experts. One, Greta Binford at Lewis and Clark. She's been on before.
Oh, sure.
You've talked with her.
Yeah, spider lady.
She wanted to give a shout out to this woman, May's tenacious curiosity and committed observation. And she points out that, you know, the amount of spider activity that she's been seeing, really, it's not altogether unusual, but it means that May's garden, which I believe is in North Carolina somewhere, must be an ideal habitat, that it's a sheltered space, but with plenty of space for web building and foraging. Linda Rayer, another spider expert at Cornell, points out that the garden must have a lot of supports for webs, things for them to hang off of, and a huge amount of prey. So I'm not sure if May thinks that's a good thing or a bad thing, having large amounts of insect prey in her yard. And she also sends this interesting tidbit about that specific species of spider. the May had been having problems sometimes seeing the mail, or she would lose the mail and say, well, where has he gone? It's been days since I've seen him. And Dr. Rayer points out that the males are hundreds of times smaller.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, than the adult females. And today's goofy science thing is the males are known apparently for mating with one of their body parts, then having a heart attack and dying while they're still attached, as it were, to sort of...
It's movie material.
Yes, keep a plug in there.
I wouldn't have learned about that if I hadn't heard about May's observations. That's wonderful.
Not only that, but she actually went and observed closely enough that she could tell the difference that there were males and females there.
Mm-hmm.
She brought that up.
Right,
wow.
So good job, May.
What about, I'd imagine this being the fall, there must have been a lot of leaves, leafy sort of things.
Oh, yes, a lot of leafy sort of things. Actually, Serena, who's she's an educator at a natural history museum, she submitted some pretty detailed observations of the diversity of leaf color change and noticing that even leaves that were the same size tended to change kind of from top to bottom. Even different trees that were right next to each other changed in different ways and at different rates. She observed tons of leaves, and actually you can see a nice collection of the leaf submissions that she sent in. There are also some other kind of offhand observations about seasonal changes. We had someone share that their squirrels seem to be getting fatter. That's absolutely an observation, and it's a kind of, you know, kind of light, absent-minded observation you might make anyway, but drawn together with many, if you know, you wanted to observe the girth of your squirrels over time, that could be kind of an interesting study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, my squirrels and I are not on a good speaking term.
There was another correspondent who carefully documented the chipmunk populations in their yard over time, and Alan was trying to reposition or relocate. Relocate the chipmunks around his house, and it didn't appear that he was having much luck. But.
Yeah, I try that too. It doesn't have much luck. Our number 844-724-8255. If you want to share with us your observing experiences, and people just looked down and found something under their stoop or back of the squirrels, whatever. Let's talk in particular a story about. That involved the GPS.
Yeah, so this is a story that's it really ties into observation and careful investigation. And it does involve a GPS, but like so many things in this world and on the internet, it all really comes back to cats.
Cats.
Yeah. How can you avoid it?
But this is, well, let's let Caroline Paul explain it to us.
One day my cat disappeared and he was gone for 5 weeks. During that time, I was super devastated. And then he just sauntered in one day and he was fat and he was fine. And I was happy he was home, but frankly, I was also felt a little betrayed. And so my partner Wendy and I decided we would follow him because I wanted to know who he was cheating on me with. So we put GPS on his collar, and we got 22 maps at all. But, I mean, you think cats sleep. I assure you, they do not. These were just lines all over the map, just gobbledygook. So we then went to a video camera, and then we went to a camera, and that, too, just didn't reveal much. So we went back to our maps, and Wendy used Photoshop, and she overlaid all 22 maps. And from there, we could see where his most frequent places were. And we labeled that the suspicious area. And after that, we decided we were going to have to use a less technological way and just go down there and talk to our neighbors to find out where these kidnappers or whoever had brainwashed my cat to love them were. And so we did it the old-fashioned way in the end and went knocking on doors and asking some really hard questions. But without the GPS and a lot of obsessive, kooky behavior, of course, we definitely wouldn't have figured it out.
So you can see some of the plots of all of this data and read more of the story at sciencefriday.com/cat-tracking. But this was a great project because... these maps that they initially made, I mean, it looked like those family circus cartoons where they follow the two kids on their path home and you get this dotted line that goes all over the place. And they really looked like nothing. And when they went through that image processing that they talked about and overlaid all the maps and filtered out the most common areas, it became very evident that they had made an observation that actually meant something.
Now, did they do this specifically because we gave them the idea that they should go out and look at something, or they were already into this?
No, this was a project that they had been working on. They actually have a book about it. If you want more information, you can read their book and get lots of detail about the mysteries of their cat. Mm-hmm.
Did we have classrooms? We always get classrooms involved.
Oh, boy, did we have
Science
classrooms.
Club. Yeah?
We had classrooms from Iowa. We had classrooms from California, Alabama, New York. The whole spectrum, and I'll say also that we had classrooms young as preschool and kindergarten, all the way up through high school and college. A couple stand out, actually. A middle school class from Sacramento, California, carefully collected weather data and climate info for all of these microclimates in their kind of the schoolyard and the area around their school to identify the best place to have a picnic. They actually took repeated measures and averages among multiple measurers. It was pretty rigorous. Another Iowa classroom, they were collecting grasshoppers around all of the fields near their school in Iowa. And they actually took all of these grasshoppers. There were many. You can see images on our site, and used dichotomous keys to identify them. So they were actually making anatomical observations in addition to basic frequency and species richness observations. And actually, this kind of brings up another point, which is that children and students are particularly good at observation. And I wanted to invite a teacher on to talk with us today. Vanessa Ford is a teacher at Maury Elementary, a DC public school. Welcome, Vanessa.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody.
Hi, it's good to talk to you.
It's great to be here. I'm really inspired. I've been writing down all these ideas that people did that I can bring back and steal in my classroom.
So I was curious, what do you think, why are students so good at observation?
That's a great question. I mean, I have two young children of my own, and then, of course, in my current job as think tank teacher here in D.C., I teach preschool through fifth. And I feel like naturally they want to know about the world around them. They're asking lots of questions all the time, incessantly. And as a teacher, I have to take those questions and try to allow them to focus a little bit. This project has allowed that to happen. But I think just naturally they're just so curious. And a lot of times they don't give them the space to observe or ask those questions. And this project has at least allowed us to do a lot of that.
Now, as a teacher, is it, and as a parent, is it our job to answer those questions? I mean, should we step in and tell students what's what or guide them around the outdoor setting?
I try not to. It's difficult not to sometimes, but what's really fascinating is that often the questions that I get, I don't necessarily know the answers to. So when you really lead students through observation or you give them something interesting to observe over time, the questions they come up with are so incredibly deep and profound, even if they're three, if they're five, or if they're 10, that we just say, hey, let's observe more, let's research more, let's collect data. And so I don't personally see it as my job to answer them. I see it as my job to bring them to a conclusion that is scientifically accurate, even if there's some detours along the way. But ultimately, if you give them the right framework for collecting that data through observation, if it's a kindergartner recording what they see and discussing it, or a fifth grader looking at an HR diagram and determining star placements and sizes, if you give them that, they will get to that conclusion themselves through observation alone.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
So you pointed out that students and kids in general are just so curious about the world. But are they? Do you think that they're really up to sort of systematic observation and getting meaningful data out of a project? Or is that something that you kind of need to ride herd on them a little bit on?
Well, I emphatically believe that they are able to do it. otherwise, I wouldn't do it. And I think part of it, though, is our jobs as science educators, elementary educators, or just educators in general, is helping them understand how to record that data and then helping them analyze it and allowing them to make mistakes and then ask them their thought process behind it. A lot of the next generation science standards and a lot of science and science practice right now is the process. So we want kids to make mistakes as long as we can bring them back around to fully understand the data. Currently, right now, for example, we have been graphing temperature data since the first week of school with third grade. And just this week, we actually looked at the data and they discovered trends and made predictions for what they believe the temperature will be 5 weeks from now.
Oh, wow.
Do we know exactly? No. But it allowed them to observe something, collect make a bar graph, systematically observe it, and make a prediction, which is something that, in the end, if they're wrong, there's no loss, but the process is what was really important.
That's incredibly helpful, Vanessa. I wanted to thank you for calling in today. Vanessa Ford is a teacher at Maury Elementary, a DC public school. She was also actually a 2014 finalist for the Presidential Awards for Excellence in Mathematics and Science Teaching. Thanks for calling in, Vanessa.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being such an inspiration to your students. So she really, her kids are, you know, we don't give kids enough credit, it sounds like, for being able to do these things on their own.
You know, we really don't. And I confess, even as a former teacher, I'm still surprised. So she had students in her classroom observing decomposition. She had students kind of trying to understand what it is about bee anatomy that makes them such good pollinators by playing with little bees. I mean, dead bees, but to be fair, bees. There's some really great inquiry going on in classrooms. And I think, you know, as a regular adult, it's kind of hard for us to imagine ourselves doing that because it's been a while since we've done it. But we all have that ability. Absolutely everyone does. And we saw that a lot in this experiment.
Yeah, there were some really insightful things. People looking at there were photos that somebody sent in of taken through a microscope of the edge of a knife blade.
Oh yeah, I saw that one.
And
yeah.
I mean, first of all, it's a beautiful image, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But it also, you know, clues you in that even though you think, oh, knife sharp, it's actually really rough there, and that's part of what makes it work. And so, you know, by observing well, you can get all of these little insights into the way the world works around you.
That really works versus what you think it is.
Oh,
you
know? Boy. I can come up with a good example of that. Speaking of mundane observations, bathroom hand washing. So one of our submitters, I think it was Beverly, submitted account of what percentage of people left the bathroom without washing their hands. She got averaged about 53%. I actually looked this up online. She's spot on with publications that have been in the American Journal of Disease Control and Infection Control. So these kinds of observations, they might not seem important, but they are. They're scientifically relevant.
Wow. We're going to take a break and come back and talk less more about our science club. If you'd like to participate, our number is 844-724-8255. We're talking about observing everything. Our Science Friday's education manager is Ariel Zitch. Our director, Charles Berquist, and your calls. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you're just joining us, you're just in time for finishing up with our science club. Yeah, it's observe everything. My guests are Science Friday's education manager, Ariel Zitch, our director, Charles Berquist, our number, 844-724-8255. Let's see if we can go to the phones for a call or two. Deborah in Wisconsin. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there.
I love birds. I love nature. And so, but there's specifically, I wanted to mention this albino pigeon that I've noticed. I bicycle for, like, exclusively for the past 3 years. And so I notice a lot more on my bicycle, and I notice this albino pigeon living underneath the expressway. And I take pictures of him, and then I notice he had a mate, a black mate. And now, just 2 days ago, I took pictures of the black and the white pigeon and their two babies. And it's just been amazing. Sometimes I'll think, oh, it's gone. I mean, he left. But maybe he went someplace else to have, or she went someplace to have the babies. So it's just very interesting because I don't see a lot of albino out in nature. But I have pictures of hummingbirds hummingbirds. I put a sickle pear up in my cherry tree, and he was there for 45 minutes to an hour. And I think he stuck his beak in there and just fell asleep. I swear.
I have to take a lesson because I can't attract hummingbirds. Charles, did you want to say something?
I'm just curious. Did the albino pigeon have albino offspring, or was there anything unusual about them?
Picture on my camera right now. I don't have internet, but I'll somehow figure out how to get it to you. But one of them is white on the bottom with black wings, and the other one is whitish, tannish brown with dark brown wing bars. And then the mom, they're on the lower metal grid, and then the mom, I think the albino is the mom, and the male's the black one, but I'm not sure. So I'm looking at the offspring, and I know it's their babies because they're so much smaller.
Did you post it on our website?
What, scienceFriday.org?
ScienceFriday.com/observeeverything. You can also tweet it to us at SciFry with the hashtag observeeverything. I've got to say, that's just so interesting to me. Pigeon plumage polymorphism, which is a description for this diversity of pigeon plumage, is so cool. It's been studied by people for hundreds of years. Charles Darwin himself was taken with that phenomenon. I myself am taken with it every time I go, like, anywhere
near. Walk out the door.
Manhattan, you got it. Exactly. I mean, there's red, there's muddled, there's hooded, there's, the whole shebang. So that's a fantastic observation. I'm excited you called in.
Yeah, post it for us, and then you can send us the photos up there, and we'll be able to share it.
I'd be happy to.
All right, thanks for calling. Happy observing. Yeah, so she's typical of the kind of people who've been sending stuff in.
Indeed. And actually, so the outdoors seem to bring observations forth en masse. We saw kind of a mix of these, one-offs, beautiful sunset or clouds or whatnot, and really in-depth observations. Some of the ones that really struck me. So Brenda actually submitted some weather observations at your prompting, Ira. So remember, we kind of, at our opening segment, we talked a bit about, okay, well, let's see if we can measure weather accuracy by observing the weather. Brenda's actually been already doing that for about 4 years.
No kidding.
She sent us her whole data set. It has about 1,500 lines of data. Each line of data has another, half dozen observations of 4-day, 3-day, 2-day, 1-day, and current weather observations as predicted by two different weather networks, and then her own weather observations.
And survey says
that they're actually really inaccurate. So her observations of current weather conditions, and all I had time to do the analysis on, I mean, to be fair, this is quite a project for anyone who's interested, but I really only had a chance to look. It's something like 30% accurate, even for the weather right now.
Just what I've been saying.
And I didn't even have a chance to look at the 4-day weather forecast. So I think, there's something to that. And that's what dedication kind of brings. She actually, when she sent it in, she said, and I'm quoting here, she said it just became kind of a habit of checking every day. So she didn't even plan on it being this kind of big project. And then when she sent it to me, she was kind of floored by her own observations.
Yeah. Do we have any idea what our next month's project is going
to
be?
Oh, my. I don't even know. I mean, these kind of all brought to my mind, at least, and Charles will probably agree with me, that there are so many ways we could take this, right? So we could do a plant project, right? The plants do amazing things. We saw some time-lapse photos of plants that were pretty unbelievable. Models, building models maybe for some scientific concept. I think we'll have to go where the wind takes us.
Okay, Charles, we'll have to see. So
Stay tuned.
You're gonna look through some of the submissions and come up with an idea, maybe.
Oh, absolutely.
What was the most surprising one that you get? Is there one, or is one that was strange looking stuff? Or
there was one that was kind of spooky, strange. Although it's completely explainable. Becky from Lansing, Michigan, noted this. She was on Google Earth, the mapping software, and she noticed this weird looking lake somewhere in Peru, and she wrote, "It looks like there's a city in the water. At first, I thought it was just a bad digitalization, but other lakes don't look like that on Google Earth. So is it any ancient quarry? Is it Inca gold?" So we were curious too, and we checked in with a couple of imaging experts. And Susan Wolfenbarger, who's at the AAAS, she actually uses remote sensing and satellite imaging to look for evidence of human rights crimes. She wrote that this weird-looking lake, which has this kind of grid in it, it looks almost like the surface of a microchip, was just the example of errors that can happen when you take the satellite imagery and crunch the numbers on it to get it into the Google Earth platform. She said it's exhibiting these artifacts from the compression that they're using to process the imagery, combined with a little bit of sensor noise, and that just throws off the image processing. But she also pointed us to this collection. I'd recommend this site called Postcards from Google Earth, which is an entire collection of images that look sort of like picture postcards of highways, but they're places where the imaging algorithm just didn't match up the overhead imagery from the satellite with the topographical information of the surface of the Earth. So you've got all of these images of bridges and highways that look like they're made of rubber.
Those are pretty cool pictures. Yeah, those are some pretty neat images. Yeah.
See, that's what happens. You never know what you're going to wind up with when people send stuff in.
Totally. I mean, the other thing that struck me, too, were the places that people were observing in. So Everything from, you know, high velocity particle physics to underwater observations from a marine sanctuary, even some where they use this CT scanner to do violin stuff. I mean, like, wow. It's just pretty wild.
And so the site is still open if people want to send more stuff
in. Yes, please. I would still love to see this stuff. I think it's fascinating.
And how do they do this?
ScienceFriday.com/Science Club. You can see the topics that we discussed today at ScienceFriday.com/Observe Everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Thank you both for coming and talking about it. We'll wait for the next one when we figure out what that is.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome. Ariel Zitch, our education manager, Charles Berquist, our director.